In our plenary this morning, we have two keynote speakers of world repute, and I'm glad to welcome Margaret Oliver and David Slaughter. And first up is Margaret Oliver. Now, Dr. Oliver, many of you will know as a geostatistics expert, she took her first degree in geography and geology at the University of Bristol in the UK, followed by a PhD in soil science at Birmingham University, again in the UK. Margaret is said to, in the biographical note, to have retired in September 2004. A person who's less retired I can't think of. But at any rate, she continues her work in precision agriculture. For some years after Pierre Robert died, she became co-editor with me of Precision Agriculture, and she's now a deputy editor of the European Journal of Soil Science. I'd like to welcome Margaret, and would you please to welcome Margaret to the stage.
Thank you, John, and thank you very much, John, and the organising committee for inviting me here to give this lecture. I'm not very keen on standing behind a lectern, but I have no option today. I like to normally move around a bit, but the screens are at an angle where I can't point, so you'll have to put up with me trying to show myself above this podium. So we're in a state in the world where there is huge competition for land and resources, people, housing, infrastructure, agriculture, and the pressure for land, soil and water is enormous. The world has never needed precision agriculture more than it does now or in the coming years. This is because PA can make so much better use of all these resources. Soil and land are finite. We depend on them for our food, fuel, fodder. But of course, there's huge competition from these other sources. Water is also a scarce resource. However, how often do we think that? Perhaps here, I noticed in the park yesterday, notices about irrigation, watering. So this part of the world does. We're profligate in the UK with water, but we have water shortages. And Headley and Jewell have shown that with careful management in agriculture, the largest consumer of water, a 20% saving was possible with good management. And we know that the underground aquifers are suffering from exhaustion, and we need to conserve. So we want to make the science and technologies of PA work for greater food security in the world. So the population is estimated to rise to 9.6 billion by 2050. That's a 35% increase on what we have at the moment. In the last 50 years, population has tripled, but the land area for agriculture has only increased by 12%. And the land per person has decreased from 0.45 of a hectare to about 0.25. We've got to produce about 70% more food for these extra people. And bearing in mind that and many of the countries are becoming more developed and want higher quality and better food. And that's going to be 100% in developing countries. Even so, we're going to still have people who are undernourished, mainly in Asia and Africa. What we need is more sustainable production from our existing land. And this is a sort of new buzz phrase, I think, sustainable intensification. I'm not going to read out this quote about what food security means because, and there are many different quotations for this, the UN one being the main one, but I think this one by Tim Benton puts it into perspective. Agriculture is central to providing us with adequate, good quality, nutritious food. That is also traceable. And we know to our cost in Europe last year the problems of food where it was contaminated by horse meat. And so we need this traceability which precision agriculture allows us to have. Insufficient food leads to malnutrition, mainly protein energy malnutrition. Now, I'm not keen on showing slides of extremes, but these two conditions, kwashiorkor and marasmus, are both extremes of malnutrition, but they occur. They're several cases of these. They're not just isolated ones. In kwashiorkor, the tissues become edematous, and in marasmus, there's a loss of muscle and growth. But these are extremes. There is a lot of malnutrition where children don't get enough food and they suffer from poor muscle development, poor growth, and then suffer from cardiac problems and diabetes later on in life. So these are serious situations. But possibly even more of a problem worldwide is undernutrition, the hidden hunger, food lacking in essential elements. And this affects more people. I think the UN's estimate of 2 billion is probably an underestimate. And we in the Western world, or people in the Western world, think we're very well fed. But in Britain, we know that many of the population are deficient in selenium, for instance. So these four elements I've listed here are extremely important, especially selenium and zinc, which have a huge effect on the proteins and enzymes in the body and play a huge role. The body can't synthesize the elements, so they must come from the food. Selenium has been added to fertilizers in Finland since 1984, and as a consequence, there's been a fourfold increase in the population's dietary intake of selenium, which is shows that by adding selenium to the fertilizers, they have certainly improved the nutrition standards. And zinc and iron can also be added in fertilizers. And this is another big opportunity for precision agriculture, because to include these trace elements. This is already the case. They are added at the moment. But I think we need to do more of this. Zinc is a real problem worldwide. It's very difficult to get enough from the foods that we have. So, wheat, rice and maize provide two-thirds of human energy. That's the sort of protein energy, calorific energy that we have. And over the past 50 years, we've seen a huge increase in food production. The cereal production increased three times in line with population growth. And we have the Green Revolution to thank for that. There was an increase in yield of cereals from 1.35 to 3.35 tonnes per hectare between the dates that you can see. And on this graph here, you can see that there are four countries, United Kingdom, Germany and France for wheat, and Japan for rice. And you can see that they follow a very similar form until the late 1980s, when they all start to plateau out. And it's interesting to contemplate, and there are lots of theories about the plateauing out of this increase. So obviously new things need to occur for us to start to try to increase production again to meet the demands that we're going to have. The Green Revolution increased yield because of improved germplasm. We all know about the dwarfing of cereals so that more of the energy went into the grain instead of into the greenery and stalks. We've had better fertiliser management, herbicides and pesticides continually being improved and updated, and improved irrigation. And so this did a lot to increase the yields. But this has been at a huge cost to the environment. We all know about the problems of nitrates, pollution of groundwaters, the effects of phosphorus with eutrophication of waters, and these are large problems that have to be managed. We've also got problems of accelerated soil erosion. Pimentel reckons that 10 million hectares per annum are lost to soil erosion. This is a huge amount of land per year. Salinization is also another huge problem in semi-arid regions, and it severely damages the soil. And again, Pimentel and Wilson reckon that 10 million hectares per annum are affected in this way. The problem with salinization is that there can be irreversible changes to the soil because of the sodium affecting the soil structure. So these have led to a decline in the soil's fertility, if you like, the crop nutrients, the cation exchange capacity, depletion of organic matter, and its water holding capacity. Because if you lose organic matter, if you lose structure, the water holding capacity of the soil declines. There's also been an increase in leaching and acidification, and we know that from farm machinery being moved overland, there's enormous compaction of the soil as well, and desertification. These lead to losses of yield. So then we've got this moves that forward then to malnutrition, moving forward to undernutrition, and also problems of toxicity in the soil. And I noticed there's a paper on the effects of toxicity in agriculture at this conference, which I shall be very interested to go to. And also I've noticed that there's a session on dealing with degradation at this conference. And I think that precision agriculture, it's developed through its technology phase, and it's become more, the science has increased over time considerably. And now I think it's the time to try to tackle the problems of soil and land degradation. The resources that involved in precision agriculture provide us with the possibilities to deal with this huge problem. We have to maintain the soil's fertility. It's the only way we're going to feed the world's population. We must focus on agricultural sustainability. And you can see from these slides the massive effects of erosion, of salinization, and of desertification. And the problem is, as well, ecosystems are becoming an important factor, managing ecosystems to improve how our environment works. And some of these effects on ecosystems might be irreversible. So what can precision agriculture do for the world, as it were? We have increasing amounts of sensor information available. We've got nitrogen sensors in crops. We can sense organic matter with imagery, soil moisture, and so on. And I think this is a very valuable resource to help to progress the limitation of degradation. We know that variable rate applications are feasible at any scale, and I was always heartened when we got papers in the journal showing the use of precision agriculture or site-specific management in small fields, especially some of the papers from Japan, managing rice on 1 hectare fields, I think shows that this is not just for the big fields of the United States or America. And so with more efficient fertilizer and pesticide use, we can benefit the environment and also the nutrient status of our food. But the problem is that determining these characteristics... Are you not hearing me?
You're not seeing the advances in the slides. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Okay. Haven't they seen any of them?
No. Okay. Is this where you're at?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm further on. So, are you seeing them now? Oh, I'm sorry about that. So, determining the nutrient concentrations of the soil, the pH and texture, these are what we need for management. They are still stumbling blocks in precision agriculture. From the first days when my students got involved in precision agriculture, it seemed to be all technology driven, and it's moved forward enormously since that stage. And so we're at a stage where precision managers need to start tackling the problems of soil erosion, desertification, salinization, and soil infertility. Also, consideration needs to be given to using cropping systems that are appropriate to the environmental conditions, and also integrated pest management so that we minimize the use of chemicals on plants and on the soil. If we want to manage in agriculture, we need detailed information. Spatial information is the core of the management. And we have to use what is available to us at the moment. And one of the ways forward, of course, is to use geostatistics, and that has been my challenge in life, to use geostatistics to improve on what is relatively poor data very often. I was just wondering whether you wanted me to flick through those slides that were missed. Yes? Right, so I'll just go through them. I won't say them all again. I'll just let you see what's there. I'm sorry about that. I'll let you read the quotation. You've seen that? Okay. There, okay. Right. Okay. Right. Now to the real nitty-gritty of the work. Now, this slide yesterday caused us a little bit of a problem, so it's not quite as pretty as it was yesterday. But geostatistics has been applied in precision agriculture since the 1980s. David Muller was the pioneer in that field, although Richard Westbury has been the pioneer in soil science. And the variogram and kriging are the central tools. The variogram is basically a simple tool. It's simply half the average squared distances between values a given distance h apart. And that gives us the semivariance. So it's simply really a variance, but based on distance. We plot the semivariances on our graph against lag interval or distance. And then we fit a mathematical function to that. And that mathematical function gives us the nugget variance, the spatially correlated components, and the range of spatial dependence. Can you see the pointer? No? So we've got three components in that graph. And those components, those model parameters, are needed for kriging, which is the geostatistical method of prediction. It's simply a local weighted moving average, and we can do that for points or blocks. So the weights are the most important part of this equation here, these weights, and those weights are derived from the variogram. And those weights for ordinary kriging, which is the main form of kriging, have to sum to one. Having said that, most of the examples I'm going to give you are not for ordinary kriging. And when they're not, I'll tell you when they're not. So the problem that we've been faced with, especially in soil science, is never having enough data. And that's often in crop science as well, where people go out and take leaves, measure things. We don't have enough data. We're very greedy in geostatistics. We want lots of data. Matteron's method of moments estimator of the variogram requires about 100 data, which is rather a lot. But if you look at the graph on the right-hand side, you'll see how the confidence intervals change as the number of samples decrease. Can you see it? It's a problem not being able to see the screen. Okay. No.
That's what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if you look at the graphs on the right-hand side, you can see how the confidence intervals change as the sampling interval increases. 25 points, you've got very wide sampling intervals. And as you come down to over 400 points, the confidence intervals decrease considerably. The graphs on the left show you what happens for a 7x7 grid. Those are multiple variograms, and they're so different. Which one would you use if you were going to do the analysis? It's very frightening. Whereas for the 15x15 grid, we've got a much better set of variograms. All isn't lost, though, because we can use residual maximum likelihood to estimate the variogram with fewer data. Has it changed? Yeah. But the sampling interval must relate to spatial scale. And we can use existing variograms of crop or soil properties, or, very importantly, variograms from ancillary data, such as aerial photographs, imagery, elevation. ECA is a very, very good. These are a very good guide to the spatial scale and those variograms. And then we can use either a rule of thumb of just less than half of the variogram range as our sampling interval, or we can actually use the kriging errors to obtain an optimal sampling interval for kriging. So here we have two aerial photographs of a 44-hectare field near to Oxford, and the sampling area was about 31 hectares. And we computed the variograms from these, and you can see that the range for coloured image is about 240 metres, and for the black and white image, just over 200 metres. And so this suggests a sampling interval of around 90 to 120 metres. So it can also, as I said, determine the kriging errors for a range of grid intervals if we have an existing variogram. We don't need any data. and we can determine it for different size of blocks. The farmer could direct that with the sort of management area he wants to use. Plot the Krieging errors against the grid spacing, and we get this graph here for different block sizes. The farmer might give you a tolerable error that he wants the estimates within. We draw that line across here for loss on ignition. We chose 0.5%, and that gave us a sampling interval of about 120 metres. And you can see as well that the range for loss on ignition for the same field was 226 metres. And all the properties that we measured in that field for soil had a similar range to the images, except for clay, which was about 160 metres. So on that basis, our ideal sampling interval would be something between 120 metres here, where we've only got 23 sites, or 90 metres as there, where we've got 36 sites. Not enough to compute a reliable variogram, as you'll see in a moment. But we thought we'd try other things as well. This is the interesting one. We had the basic 120 metre grid with some additional samples at 60 metres to give us 50 data, and then computed variograms by method of moments and residual maximum likelihood. Can you see, are they on? Yeah. So you can see that this is for the full data. We have a very good model. The slightly different for REML, which is the dotted line, than for the method of moments, but they're very similar. When we get to 70 sites, there's a slight degradation in the variogram compared with the one for the full data, which is there. 36 sites, the method of moments variogram doesn't resemble the original variogram at all, whereas the REML one is very close. 23 sites, the variogram is pure nugget. It's a straight line across there from MOM, method of moments. REML still manages to produce a reasonable variogram. And then for the 120 plus 60 metre grid, you can see that we've got a reasonable variogram from both, which is interesting. So, I'm sorry about that. Right, these are the maps that we produced from this then. So you can see this is for the... What's happening? Do you want to go to the other format, because in case it's more secure?
Now you can see that.
Okay.
I think it's clicking out of the presentation.
Okay. Right, so these are the maps that we produced with this, and you can see that on the left-hand map at the top, for all the sites, we've got a very detailed map. It's showing a lot of variation. When we degrade that to 60-metre data, you can see that we've lost information. By the time we get to 90 metres with the method of moments, one MOM at the top, we've got a real loss of information. By the time we get to 120 metres here, we couldn't use the variogram, obviously, just ordinary interpolation. We knew the data was spatially dependent, so that was acceptable. You shouldn't interpolate unless you've got spatially dependent data, and it's pure rubbish, really. At 120 to 6 and 60 metre interval, we've got the pattern being restored. It isn't as accurate, but it's good. So we move to REML now, the 60 metre. You can see it's reasonable. It's similar to MOM. And then for 90 metres, it's much better than the method of moments for REML, and 120 is very good indeed, surprisingly, considering how few data, and again for 120. So you can see the effects on the maps of that. Another possibility is to use what's called the standardised variogram. We used a standardised variogram of electrical conductivity. That was... No? Do you want to go to that other format in case that's what's causing it? Can I have more time, Mr. President, please? Right. I'm really sorry about this, but it isn't my fault for once. Right, the standardized variogram. What it means is that it's, you know, standardization to zero mean and unit variance. So with the variogram SIL will be at 1. If you standardize your data as well, then the variogram from a different variable is compatible with your data. So we used it with loss on ignition, a variogram from electrical conductivity. At the top here, we've got the original map. Then this is the map with 23 below it is the map with 23 data. And the standardized variogram. And I think this is excellent, considering the small amount of effort that went into that analysis. And then with an additional 15 sites, we improved the pattern slightly more. Those 15 sites are shown as those triangles and circles and squares on the map. So sampling is a very big issue. It's a very big issue in precision agriculture. Until we can get some form of technology that can measure soil properties very quickly. And this method of Marchant and Lark for an adaptive form of sampling is very good. If you've got something that can be measured quickly, like soil moisture with a theta proof. There's no variogram to start with, and you have to guess a distribution for the variogram in this Bayesian approach. So each sampling phase was optimized iteratively based on an objective function, which was an approximation to the Krieging variance. And then at each phase, the variogram distribution of parameters is updated. And so, as I say, they studied soil moisture content. This survey was a small area, admittedly, but it took less than 3 hours to do this. And it's very advantageous for use with sensors. So they started off with 30 observations in the top left-hand diagram based on their guess of the distribution of the variogram parameters. Added 30 more points to the square 2, then another 10 points in square 3, and 5 more points in square 4. And their final sampling was an additional 4 points. Interestingly in this, we have points that are far apart, but also a lot of samples that are close together. That's important in estimating the variogram, to get the definition of the variogram near to the origin. So this is a very efficient approach. Another, Corwin and Lesh used ancillary data, ECA data, to guide sampling for their delineation of management zones. Management zones are a very good interim stage in site-specific management where we don't have a lot of information. So you can see the distribution of the sampling points in this map here, and then the Krieged maps of the four properties that they were looking at for the maps of the four properties that they were looking at for the delineation of the zones. And they used a linear mix model with the Krieg data to delineate these management zones. And you can see here that in the red zone at the top, there was a need to reduce the electrical conductivity of the saturation extract, in the blue area to reduce the leaching fraction, and in the bottom right-hand side to, requires more irrigation. I think the pH they could leave because they're such small areas. But this is an example of where there was a mixed use of different types of analysis, geostatistics and the linear mix model. Ancillary data can also be used to improve prediction with different forms of kriging. And Gouvets and Kerry incorporated secondary information to estimate sand content in the soil using co-kriging, kriging with external drift and kriging with local means. They all have slight problems, these methods, in that co-kriging requires the cross-variogram to be modelled, which is not easy, and kriging with external drift and simple kriging both require the ancillary data to be in the same points as your estimation points, and that can be quite difficult. If you look at the table below, you'll see that I've put co-kriging in blue because the results from the cross-validation show that the mean absolute error for that was the smallest, and also the mean squared deviation ratio was also close to 1, as it was, incidentally, for ordinary kriging. Ordinary kriging performed the worst, and simple kriging, kriging with external drift and co-kriging were the two best methods. So the cross-variograms here, the reason this is difficult is because you have to be able to fit the same function to all three variograms, or even more, or four variograms in this case. And also, you have to have the same range for those variograms. And this can only be where your properties are varying in harmony. And what it shows here that the is that the variogram for sand and the aerial image is actually, the cross variogram is the best. It shows it's closer to the outer limits, which is called the hull of perfect correlation. You can see that for sand and electrical conductivity and aerial, ECA and aerial, the correlation is somewhat weaker. So you can see the kriged maps from this analysis, the ordinary kriged maps, and then next to it there is the co-kriged map. They all show some similarities, and from a management point of view, the farmer could use any one of these. But it does show that co-krieging, that if you've got too few data, the ancillary data can improve the estimates somewhat. Some more in some cases than for this one. Pringle et al. Used geostatistics for local response experiments. They examined the fine scale response of yield to different inputs. And they used yet another form of kriging, standardised co-kriging, which takes account of the means of the different treatments. So they had four different treatments of nitrogen, zero, and then three other amounts. And zero showed, obviously, the poorest response in yield, but the other three were all very, very similar. So the left-hand map shows you the complex pattern that they had. This was a field in Bedford John, so you probably, it's close to you. And a very complex experiment here. And then you, on the right-hand side, you can see these co-kriged maps. The one at the top left-hand side is the one for zero nitrogen, and you can see the yield response there is poor. But for the other three maps, 100 grams of nitrogen per hectare, 170 and 225, there's very little difference in the responses. And so the farmer could save a lot of money if he had that information beforehand and know that he needn't go beyond the 100 kilograms per hectare. The other thing is, as well, from this map, the aim of this map was actually to see where they could save money in the application of nitrogen and reduce the amount of nitrogen added, because we have these nitrate vulnerable zones in Britain where nitrogen has to be managed incredibly carefully, and that was one of them. Now, space-time geostatistics is going to be one of the exciting areas in precision agriculture to come, because we're going to link variation in time and space. There's already work going on in this, but at the moment the software needs to catch up with ordinary mortals, because at the moment the software tends to be rather difficult. Hervelink and Van Egmond, they used it with a potato crop, and their aim was to fine-tune fertilizer application and also to remove the above-ground biomass before harvest. But it can also be used for decisions on irrigation and pesticide application. So it's not just for those two things. So you can see that they used NDVI over a period of time, and you can see the huge spatial variation in the upper graph because of the variable development in the crop. On the left-hand bottom map, you can see that the variety Sophista is very slow to develop, whereas the variety on the right, Innovator, developed much more quickly. But by the 27th of July, they were even. So they computed the variogram in space and time, and both of those sources have to be modelled separately, as they do in co-kriging, and then also the space-time function. And you can see here the model, the sum metric model. And the function, the component in that equation, alpha, is the one that joins together the space and the time component. So that it matches time and distance in space, so that all the points on that ellipse have the same semivariance. And that model then enabled them to do space-time kriging. On the upper left-hand side, you can see the experimental space-time variogram. It's quite noisy because they didn't have a lot of data in time. The right-hand side, you can see the fitted exponential function to that. And the temporal range was 8 days, and the spatial range was 100 metres. So the change is taking place, on average, over about 8 days. And the maps show you the development through time. Now, they had hundreds of these maps that they showed to the farmer like a moving image, like a video image. And so what you can see is that the Sophista, which developed late, actually died down more quickly. And so they could harvest that left-hand side of the field in August earlier than the right-hand side of the field. So the aim was to help the farmer with his management decisions. Right, this is John will be glad this is the last bit, the geostatistical simulation. I'm sorry we've been held up a little bit. Robin Gebbers showed quite recently that simulation has a role to play in precision agriculture. Up until now, it's really been the tool of the petroleum geologists. They're the people who've used simulation the most. It incorporates uncertainty into the modelling, and we get a more realistic impression of the variation. And the simulation can be conditioned on data, or it can be unconditioned with no information and just a variogram. In both cases, we need the variogram. But there are always drawbacks, aren't there? Kriging is the best local estimator. It's often called the blue estimator, but it smooths. It overestimates the smallest values and underestimates the largest values, so we lose variance. Simulation doesn't lose variance. It keeps the original variance in the data and that texture that was present as well. And you can have lots of realizations to look at the possible variation present in a field. The problem is the expense is at local accuracy in the ultimate predictions or simulations. And you can see from the bottom graph here, the red line is the Krieg estimates between the conditioning points. You can see it's very smooth. The dotted line are the simulated values, and they wiggle around a bit. The red thin lines are the Krieging errors, and you can see that they are smaller than the simulation errors, which can be enormous in places. So these are the maps. They don't look hugely different from one another after all that. The simulation map, which is the second from the left, I'm not sure if this pointer causes the problem, but that map there is based on 100 realizations of that variation. And you can see from the bottom graph on the left-hand side that the simulated values show the large values and the very small values, whereas the Krieg estimates don't. But then you come to the errors, and the simulation errors are very large compared with the Krieg errors. And then we move to the right-hand maps, which are of the Krieging standard deviations or the Krieging errors. For Krieging, the errors depend only on the distance from the sampling point, so they're very regular. If you look at the bottom right-hand graph, I think it's quite frightening because the simulation errors are affected by the value of the property. So they're large errors where the property values are small, and even larger errors where the property values are large. So it has its problems. So why bother to use it then in that case? It does have a value, and I think that this is a really great value in being able to determine the probabilities, because it's very difficult with disjunctive Krieging, whereas this is much easier. And you can see in the left-hand graph here, yes, okay, John, I'm aware. I've got three more slides. Anyway, when the graph comes up, on the left-hand side, it shows that you've got these probabilities. Right, on the left-hand side, we've got the probabilities of the pH being less than 5.8. Now, clearly in that field, the farmer really has got to do quite a lot of amendments to the soil pH there. But the probabilities are excellent in being able to guide management. This field, they can't save an enormous amount of effort here, but it will save some effort. And you can see that there are a few areas that are likely to exceed the pH of 6.3. So where next? First, in precision agriculture, where are we going to go? I think one of the areas is in the developing countries. Fertilisers there are extremely costly and scarce, and I think their precision agriculture has great potential. In the book I edited recently, there's a chapter on the developing world, and I think this is an area where the expertise is really needed. We tend to dismiss these areas of it not being of any value, but it is. We want to use the technology and scientific expertise in precision agriculture to tackle land and soil degradation. And Hatfield and Kitchen recently said that we should be moving from the diagnostic phase to the prescriptive phase of PA. We've moved from the pure technology and we've gone to diagnostic. We now need to move to the prescriptive phase and also become much more proactive in some of the things that are done. We need to use our sensor information. This is such a valuable source, better, and it's cheap to obtain. There's going to be advances in crop physiology, and I think that we need to take the management of trace elements very seriously. And finally, geostatistics needs to reflect the changes in types of data. We want better approaches to sampling. We don't want to just be stuck with grids. It isn't always the best approach. We need software that for space-time geostatistics is much easier to manage than at present, but not a black box approach. Use more soft data and also simulation for identifying these uncertainties in mapping, but also to determine the probabilities for management. That's a very good approach. And finally, I'd like to thank the contributors to geostatistical applications for precision agriculture for letting me use some of those examples. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And I'm very sorry that the technology didn't work as it should have done, but I don't know why. So.
Margaret, I want to say a very big thank you to you for that presentation. Isn't technology wonderful? Until it stops working.
Yeah.
Now, I do think, because we did have those delays, there's time for perhaps one or two questions.
Okay.
If there are one or two questions from the audience, there is a roving mic somewhere. If you'd like to put your hand up if you'd like to ask a question. Do I see a question anywhere? There's one right over there. And can I say, Margaret, that the technology might have failed, but quite honestly, you were so interesting in your presentation that, in a sense, it didn't matter that we didn't see the slides there.
And all the effort I've put into those slides.
We saw them. Okay,
my question,
please.
I think, is very simple. Given that I did not understand most of what you presented, and the rest of the audience did, is there a way for us to get a copy of your presentation?
Yeah, I'll make it into a PDF for you.
That would be lovely. Thank
also,
you.
Also, part of the geostatistics part has been written up in a small pamphlet produced by the International Fertilizer Association. So I've got that reference came through for me this morning. So I've got that.
Good. Thank you very much. Is there one more question? I think, yes, we've got time for another question. So, over here, if you keep your hand up, please.
I probably should have used my own computer.
My question is about the slide that you had where you were showing 30 meter, 60 meter, 90 meter,
yeah.
120 meter. It looked like when you combined 120 with some 60, that you actually gained more information than you had in the 60 alone.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that is maybe something positive for the adaptive gridding that, it looked like you were oversampling in the locations where you had a lot of variance. So you actually gained more information than the 60?
Yeah. I think, yes, the advantage of the 120 and the randomly placed 60-meter ones, because those were selected from the 60-meter grid at random, the additional samples, and they weren't everywhere. But the advantage is that if you have a basic grid with some additional short interval sampling in between, the variogram improves enormously, and so do the Krieg predictions, because the Krieg predictions are only as good as the variogram. And people, even now, I still get papers through. John sends me them occasionally. No variogram presented. And please, any of you doing geostatistics, if you don't send the variogram, the paper will go back. Because without knowing what the variogram is like, the Krieg map could be anything. I can make magical maps with very few data. And I've seen them. And that's what got me into all this in the first place. So, Chris Dawson had a lovely word for this. Mapping pornography. Beautiful maps with no substance.
I think that's a good place to close. And let's give Margaret another round of applause.